When did science put its hooks in you? Did you know as a kid that you
Oh,
were
yeah.
bound for a career?
When I was little, my parents told me that I always wanted to be one of two things. One was a garbage man, and the other one was a doctor.
Hello and welcome to the Bloodstream Podcast. My name is Patrick James Lynch, alongside co-host
Amy Board.
And we are very happy to be back with another episode of the Bloodstream Podcast. Today's episode is going to take a look at conversations we had with four expert hematologists during the Bleeding Disorders Conference last week in the Clinician's Corner, part of the Science Fair, thesciencefair.org. Shout out to Spark Therapeutics for making that possible. Amy and I had the pleasure and honor of talking to four expert hematologists for hours. And we were able to take all of that, well, Amy primarily, and break it down and find some of the most valuable insights and shares from the hours and hours and hours that we spent with these experts to bring them to you here. So we're going to get into that in just a moment. But before we do, Amy, there's huge news that came out this morning. We're recording this on Wednesday, the 19th. And this morning, and I'll read directly from what I read when I woke up. It was a headline from Reuters, which read, US FDA rejects BioMarin Hemophilia A gene therapy shares dive. So the news did come down today. It's been anticipated now for quite some time that in August, the FDA would be giving their response to BioMarin's application for approval on their gene therapy product. This morning, the FDA said not quite yet. At the time that we're recording this, I'm sure many organizations have by now posted their statements. I saw the Hemophilia Federation of America's first. I'll read part of that right now. Many patients and their families will be disappointed to learn that gene therapy for hemophilia remains out of reach for the time being. It has been a decades-long, dearly held hope that patients could gain access to a single-dose treatment that would eliminate bleeding and improve quality of life. Always, though, HFA and the overall patient community have also insisted that health and safety remain paramount, especially in view of our community's devastating history with tainted treatments in the 1970s and 80s. With health and safety as our principal touchstones, the patient community relies on the FDA to adhere to its established, quote, gold standard, quote, review processes and rigorous science. AHFA will continue to monitor developments as BioMarin works with the FDA to provide the additional data the FDA has requested. So again, the news is that the FDA has denied BioMarin's application. It is not a slammed door. They need more data, so the process will continue. But Amy, this is big news.
Yeah, I think it was, it's shocking news. From what we heard, I mean, it was just resounding that it's like, well, this is going to happen. I mean, we kind of giggled. It was one conversation was like, it's in 18 days. Like, are we going to be prepared in 18 mm-hmm. days? So I think everybody feels a little shocked. I feel shocked, and it took me a little bit to have it sink in. And in all honesty, you know, from my personal chair, I'm not a clinician, I'm not a patient, so take this with a grain of salt. But from my viewpoint, I agree. I agree with the decision. I think more data is always good. And I also think that the infrastructure hasn't been addressed in terms of where would you go to receive this one treatment? Do doctors have to be certified to give this one treatment? You have to be followed for a certain amount of time. That was all kind of elusive in terms of what it would actually be if it was a free-for-all. So I agree it's so disappointing, but at the same time, I don't think it's a dream that's going away. In fact, I wonder what the momentum will continue to look like as we gather more data. And I also wonder, this is a question, I'm not even sure, will the clinical trial still be open to folks that want to maybe get in on the trial? Is that a thing?
I don't know. As we often say, we're not doctors, but I don't think so. If my understanding is correct, the ask is really for more long-term data from the existing trial participants.
Sure.
I don't believe additional trial participants are part of what is being asked for. I don't know if that's a decision that BioMarin and the trial constructors could decide for other reasons, but I don't necessarily think so. To the point that you made, Amy, just a few very well-known hematologists, many of whom were part of presentations on novel therapies and gene therapy only a week ago at the BDC, chiming in. Dr. Robert Sedonio said that he was a bit shocked that they could not have provided this advice, the FDA, that is, before, and that they wasted effort, time, and money, a comment that got a lot of support on Facebook. On the other side of things, we talk about Professor Michael Makris in the UK, here and there on Bloodstream. He had a tweet earlier today. There will always be uncertainties in gene therapy and hemophilia. The key issues for me are the percentage needing steroids in the first 6 months and durability of response. I do not believe the BioMarin phase 1-2 study provided data on a large enough number to allow adequately informed decisions. And then going back the other way, we've mentioned his name a couple times, Dr. Guy Young tweeting, I'm honestly shocked. Huge setback for hemophilia. Makes no sense. FDA asking for 2-year data from phase 3 study to address durability concerns. The durability question is a 5 to 10 year question. Head scratching emoji. So to your point, Amy, I think there's a lot of thoughts, feelings. I've seen patients and families, to HFA's statements point, posting that they're disappointed in this decision. I was surprised as well this morning to see this. Although I have to say, Amy, I hear you on this. Maybe this is the right decision. I don't know the ins and outs of when the FDA could communicate certain things at certain times to not waste time, effort, and money. I'm going to put that to the side for now. But based on the conversations we were having last week about all of the big questions around what does it mean for this to be introduced, to your point, how will clinics be set up to administer it? Is there enough support in those clinics to administer and follow up with patients? Because it is a lengthy process in the beginning. It's to the point about the first 6 months and steroids. It's the one and done is the long-term vision and truth. It is not the short-term experience when it is working well. So are we set up for it? Is the insurance and payer system set up and ready to accommodate what it means? They'll tell you we can't do that unless we know about the durability. Is this one and done? Because it gets priced differently depending on the value it's adding. Fair. So yes, as we were talking about potentially being like days away from an approval, I did think, frankly, at that time, we were talking about a pending approval, even though it was not. Obviously, that wasn't going to be the case, but I did think we were moving toward that. And I had some trepidation about all the unknowns that still existed. So I do appreciate, and HFA made the point about health and safety, and there are a lot of treatments available for the management and treatment of hemophilia. We are unlike 95% of the rare disease population in the United States for whom there is not one FDA-approved medication to treat their diseases, not one. We have many within hemophilia. Now, gene therapy is it's like the great white whale or whatever, right? It's the thing out there that we're all striving toward. But until it is where it needs to be to satisfy durability, safety, effectiveness, until we have the support system and clinical care necessary to bring patients along this journey, until our healthcare system is set up to accommodate what this brand new classification of drugs is going to mean, until some of these things are addressed, I honestly don't know that we can have a gene therapy that's commercially available in the United States. And if there are patients that are desperate or are really hungry for it for whatever totally legitimate reasons, there are clinical trials that enroll all around the world for different gene therapies. If you're in a very desperate situation, I don't know about compassionate use with gene therapy and how that's working. Mm-hmm. In theory, there are options for you, but I guess I do skew on the side of being a bit conservative. So my instinct is, yeah, there were a lot of questions that were up there. So if the FDA feels like we need more time, I can't really disagree with that from my patient, non-hematological or expert point of view.
Yeah, I agree. And for patient families and for consumers, you know, having more data to have underneath your belt, you know, going into some of these massive decisions. And I mean, I think that's the thing that I came away with from the BDC is for the first time in hemophilia, I mean, truly there is a paradigm shift in treatment. And so the expertise needed for the prescriber is going to increase. It's going to become more nuanced. And this FDA rejection does not mean that it's not quote unquote working. There's just so many nuanced right. science. So it's not like it's dead in the water at all. It's just there's more data. There's more, there just needs to be more information. And I think it's still an encouraging time, to tell you the truth. In fact, I think it's a massively encouraging time. I think if it was approved today, in my humble opinion, I would put on my seatbelt and be like, giddy up, let's go. Like, who knows? Like, it's the Wild Wild West.
I'd be celebrating. I would acknowledge there's a lot we don't know. These questions are still unanswered. That doesn't change because there was a different outcome.
Right.
We would just buckle up for it. But given that this is the reality, I do breathe a little bit of a sigh of relief in a way.
Right.
And I'm glad that we can kind of tiptoe a bit closer before we run.
And I will say, you know, leading into some of the clips that we're going to play you today, we have in our grasp, in my opinion, are very accessible, some physicians and top minds that are truly positioned to help disseminate all of this stuff that's happening. I think the conversations we had during our Clinician's Corner at the Science Fair during BDC were so enlightening. Everybody kind of comes from a different angle. NHF CEO is a physician. He has been in the gene therapy field now, my goodness, for a decade. We are well positioned to, like, as a community, to continue growing in our knowledge and expertise going into that room where we make the decision of what we want to do with our treatment going forward. And that's so encouraging to me. And so I want to acknowledge the disappointment. I think the disappointment is real, but
yes,
I also
it is.
Want to still, you know, I don't know, kind of, there's still hope. There's still hope and there's still encouragement because it's not halted. Nothing's halted.
You mentioned it earlier. Durability was the big issue in question. How long will this maintain in the body? But from my opinion, if you're talking about, hey, you might have to take a shot every 2 to 4 to 5 years where we are right now, I mean, that's a huge step forward. So it comes back to expectations. It comes back to what is the need being met and is what is being provided and the data supportive of that need. And the FDA says not yet, but this is a hopeful time. This is a very hopeful time. I agree with you on that.
And I guess I just want to implore listeners, if you have some thoughts or even emotions you want to share about this, to like reach out to Patrick and I. We're really accessible on social media and through email. I know Patrick would. I know Patrick gets this regularly. To just share, we would love to kind of hear what the community heartbeat is about this stuff, because it's big. This is a big news.
Absolutely. And if it's not something you want to be shared on air, like, you can just just send us a message and talk to us as people. And then if it's something that we can talk about, we'll ask you. But, you know, this is a community podcast. This is why we're here. This is part of the idea of Bloodstream, that when moments like this happen, there's somewhere to go to kind of process, hear from some experts, get involved in a conversation, especially in a year like this where we don't have the ability to do that in person. So with that, Amy, I think we should start moving into the first segment.
Sounds great. I'm so excited for you guys to hear these conversations.
So
they were a highlight for me.
And me as well. Yeah, Amy and I, every time we kind of walk in there, it's like, wow, this is like some dense stuff. We had an hour with each one of these brilliant minds to just grill them in the way that we wanted to. So
and we would be talking to these guys and we'd be texting each other like, that was incredible.
Oh, that was amazing.
That was amazing.
Did I understand that right? It was like real nerdy stuff, but it was a highlight for me too. So so here first is Dr. Valentino talking about this idea of, are we prepared for new therapies? Let's take a listen.
From a broad perspective, Len, we had the science fair last year, and now a year later, the science fair again this year at the virtual BDC. What's maybe prioritized in thinking about non-factor therapies, gene therapy, future of therapy, and the models to support it, the treatment and management concerns, the sustainability of the models. Have any of those bumped up significantly in prioritization for you since we were here together a year ago?
I would say that still at the top of the list is safety. We have to ensure that we have safe medications, whether that's, factor replacement therapies or non-factor treatments or a gene therapy or, some other cellular therapy. I think that we have to demonstrate clear safety of these. Now, obviously, we're not going to have the long-term safety data that we would want going into this. But I think we have to have some reasonable reassurance of the safety of these products that we cannot have sort of the age of enlightenment and enthusiasm that followed factor concentrates and then sort of the bursting of the balloon with HIV. And we cannot have that type of, situation recur because we're not being thoughtful enough and really looking carefully at these different treatment modalities. I think we hopefully have learned our lesson once, but sometimes memory gets short, and I think we really have to be careful. So safety for me, so the safety summit was something that I anticipate continuing. I think that's something that we probably need at least once a year. It may be something that we need to do more frequently as well. And maybe some, a national safety summit and then potentially some regional smaller safety summits if we can ever get back to working, face to face. So safety, I think, is paramount. And obviously then we have to have products that are effective and are that are cost effective as well. And, I think we can come up with lots of treatments that are effective, but they really have to provide incremental benefit over what we currently do. I think Hemlibra has demonstrated that to a great degree where, in the inhibitor population, it's unquestionable that the incremental benefit is tremendous.
Yeah.
In the non-inhibitor population, I think we need more data. I still think, we have an anecdotal experience of 6,000 people, but we don't have, the data collection in those people in terms of, sort of these, the immediate effects, I think, are clear in terms of the cessation of bleeding and the resolution of target joints, and actually improvement in joint function. Because probably, you're not bleeding, you don't have as much inflammation, and you're able to do some physiotherapy and have more activities. But are there the same long-term benefits to joints and muscles, the musculoskeletal system, that we recognized and appreciated with factor replacement therapy? So we do need to have those long-term studies, and if it's the joint outcome study that's done for non-factor therapies, then, that's what we need. But we need safe, but also effective medications that are demonstrated to be safe for the important outcomes that you want. It's not what I want, as a clinician, it's what you want as a patient. And I think that's where we really need to start focusing our efforts is, these patient important outcomes. I don't like the term patient reported outcomes. I really like the-
Why is that?
Well, I think patient reported is important, but I could ask you to report something that's irrelevant to you. I want something that you're going to report that's relevant and important in your life. So that's where I think it's the patient important outcomes or patient relevant outcomes that are so important that we need to be focusing on, especially as we get to moving, the community from acute management, which was really in the 70s, that was the age of, people having to go to the hospital to get infused and having to go to a clinic to get infused. Now, we're sort of in this chronic disease management state where people are in, managing their disease at home, and it's a chronic disease more than anything else. But as we move forward, it's not even a chronic disease. We're looking at, the opportunities for cure. you know, it may not be here today, it may not be tomorrow, but it's going to be, you know, it's soon that we're going to be knocking on the cure doorstep. And then it becomes, what are the outcomes that are relevant to people in that state, as opposed to the control of bleeding. You know, it's more lifestyle. How do we empower people who have inherited bleeding disorders to feel fully empowered to live their life to the way they choose and not be encumbered by a bleeding disorder?
Given, you know, you mentioned maybe not today, not tomorrow, but a cure is the goal, that is what is at the end of the tunnel. But very soon we may have gene therapeutics available for patients. To your point about safety as a top concern, and considering that we're living through a pandemic as well, do you have any concerns about that reality, whether it's sooner or later, right? It's coming very soon one way or another. Are we well set up for it?
I don't know if we're, as a community, we're prepared. Again, for one-time therapies, I don't think we as not a hemophilia or a bleeding disorders community, but as a community at large, we're not ready for. I think, you know, we're already being challenged with Zolgensma for spinal muscular atrophy, you know, and certainly as other one-time therapies come out, we definitely need to figure out the reimbursement strategy. So in that respect, no, we're not. And I think from a medical perspective, we might be, but I think there's still a huge education gap that exists among clinicians about these therapies, and really feeling comfortable and empowering clinicians to have the conversation with patients. You know, it's all about a shared decision-making process. And I'm not sure that clinicians feel fully comfortable having this conversation. I mean, I'll tell you that, you know, being immersed in gene therapy for 2.5 years, I'm not sure that I'm fully comfortable having that conversation with a patient. And that's all I did for 2.5 years. Mm-hmm. And thinking about the strategy of how you educate patients and educate clinicians, I think it's a tall order. This is not something we learned in medical school or nursing school. So it's a completely different mindset. You know, we're looking at things like, can we develop a gene therapy academy where we can, you know, provide some immersive training for people around gene therapy and advanced technologies? You know, so I think in that respect, we're probably not ready. And one of the main reasons that I thought me coming to NHF would be a good thing is I also think that the patient community is not prepared. And this was an opportunity for me to share and to really work more closely with the patient community to prepare patients and families for one-time therapies. And again, whether that's gene therapy or a cellular therapy, I think we've got a long way to go. And, you know, my fear is that patients will see a gene therapy as the shiny ball in front of them and grasp for it and really not understand all of the implications just because it's, you know, new and shiny and I'm going to take it. It really has to be done in a thoughtful and careful way because we don't understand all the risks that are associated with these new therapies.
And what you mentioned, the knowledge gap amongst clinicians, not your exact words, but that there was something to that effect. How does that get addressed? The community piece is kind of a separate piece, but I'm curious, what are some of the tactics being used to help address that piece of the education burden?
Well, I think each of the developers of novel therapies are experts in their own molecule, technology, whatever it is. So there's some expertise that we can garner from the people who are developing them. They're the experts. However, you know, having participated and been in, you know, I guess 4 different companies, you know, in over 7 years, there's always some skepticism regarding information and educational materials that might come from a company. So I really see that the future is that we need to develop ways to partner with the experts. So I see NHF again as in a extremely well positioned to be able to do this, where you know, we can take an unbiased approach, but we can partner with the experts. So we can partner with, you know, drug developer number three and utilize their experts to impart that wisdom and that knowledge that they've got to, for example, a writing group. And then maybe it's a series of monographs that are developed on individual molecules that are developed, you know, with a level of transparency and a level of openness that we communicate, you know, freely and openly. You know, I know that companies are often constrained by what they can and can't say because of compliance and legal issues, and frankly, marketing issues as well. But I think being able to collect that information from a company and then using, you know, an unbiased external writing group, for example, to create a series of monographs about each individual molecule is one of the things that I thought really strongly about that I'd like to undertake, you know, on behalf of NHF, put together groups of experts that can do this. So I think that's one way. Another thing that we're looking to do is to have a new conference on gene, cellular, and novel therapies, purely an educational conference. And the target of this type of conference would be the healthcare professionals. But of course, it would be open to patients, and it would be open to policymakers. And you know, the broad community could attend, but really the presentations would be geared towards healthcare professionals, and with a goal of increasing their level of knowledge around these novel therapies. And you can see that there could be multiple different approaches taken. There could be some of the science, you know, the what went into developing these molecules, the clinical trials, but then also discussions and presentations around reimbursement, around the policies that are part of all of this. So I think that type of a conference is we're ready for that. And we're ready to do it from, you know, an unbiased way, so that it's not a company, a for-profit company that's doing this, but it's, you know, NHF on behalf of the inherited bleeding disorders community. But it could even be broader than that. It could be on behalf of the rare blood disorders community as well, because I think the same things that we're dealing with hemophilia and bleeding disorders are going to be true for von Willebrand disease and thalassemia and sickle cell disease as well. So I think it's more around blood diseases that we need that education. And frankly, you know, the target audience, the hematologists, we care for all of these diseases. So I think there's a lot of economy of scale there by talking about those diseases.
Hey, Patrick here. Quick interruption with a reminder that the Bloodstream podcast, this episode and every episode, it's made possible by Takeda. And if you want to learn more about Takeda and their commitment to the bleeding disorders community, there's a really, really complicated website I got to send you to, bleedingdisorders.com. Did you get that? It is bleedingdisorders.com to learn more about Takeda and their commitment to our community. And as always, for your support of the Bloodstream podcast, we say thanks, Takeda.
I loved that conversation with Dr. Valentino. And Patrick, I know you and I discussed this, but just to reiterate that NHF truly is positioned to lead some of these discussions on safety, on some of the questions, the infrastructure. They truly are positioned well to help us in this time as we go into the unknown, man.
Yeah, they are. And I think they've never been more receptive to the patient voice guiding how we get there. So if you are interested in contributing to that part or any part of NHF's work, this year is the year to reach out and get involved. So changing gears a little bit, next we're going to hear from Dr. Guy Young. Before gene therapy was the thing on the horizon, this thing called emicizumab was, and now it has been around for a couple few years, and some of the questions that there were when that was first approved have since been answered, or at least have started to get answered. Dr. Young will talk more about that right now.
I think the challenging area is with those new parents of very young babies. I've had several of these in the last few months. How do you, you know, in the past, the discussion was easy. There is no treatment we can give your very, very young baby right now, and we'll just wait it out. And when they get older and they start to bleed, 9 months, 1 year, year and a half, you know, then, you know, when they have a joint bleed, or even if they don't, we can start talking about prophylaxis. And the reason is that intravenous therapy, you know, 1 week old, 2 week old, 3 month old is really essentially almost impossible. I mean, you'd have to put in a central venous catheter, not a port because they're too small, a central venous catheter that sticks out through the skin, something called a Broviac or Hickman catheter. Those things are notoriously risky for getting infected. How do you wash your baby? I mean, we didn't do that before, and we don't do it now because of all those risks. But here comes a drug that can be given subcutaneously. And for all the way people might feel about, emicizumab, the reality is it is given subcutaneously. So therefore, we have an option now to start treatment literally like right out of the womb, right out of the uterus after delivery. We have that option because to give a subcutaneous medication to a baby that young is really not a problem. Yeah, it's a needle. It hurts a little. They cry. But I mean, it's logistically actually quite simple. And you know, for really sick babies in the neonatal intensive care unit, they get subcutaneous injections all the time. So the question with emicizumab is we can give it at a very, very, very young age. Really, the question is, should we? And if we want to, what would be the reason? And since there's no data on babies that young, at least as of yet, how do we know it'll work? And do we have to monitor it? And what are the risks? And so, you know, it sort of opens a Pandora's box of questions by having this option. And so, yes, the discussion with the parents of newborns is very different now than it was, you know, 2 years ago, because we have to include that as an option. And I discussed that actually in great detail in the talk I gave at ISTH. And I was actually asked to write a review article based on that talk, which I'm going to start working on soon. But really, the whole issue revolves around intracranial hemorrhage. So bleeding in the brain in hemophilia, in general, is not common. It occurs about 5%, 6% of the time. But when it does occur, most of those, the vast majority, 90% of those, occur before 9 months of age. So again, in
that's
the past,
super interesting. I did not know that. That's interesting.
Yeah, that's been demonstrated in multiple, you know, sort of natural history studies. So in the past, you know, we had to kind of throw our hands up. There's not much we couldn't do anything. I would explain to the parents, look, this can happen. Here are the symptoms, and if you feel like your child's having those symptoms, you know, call us or come to the emergency room right away. And yeah, it happens every year. I have at least one. I just had one a few weeks ago. Every year I have at least one baby that has that situation. Before Hemlibra, there was no, right, we couldn't really do anything. We just say, well, let's keep our fingers crossed. If it happens, we'll treat it right away and we'll deal with it. But now there's an opportunity to give a medication that presumably should be effective at improving the coagulation status of that baby. And therefore, in theory, and I stress in theory, should be effective to prevent intracranial hemorrhage. Now, we talked about, you know, can we do a study? The answer is really no, because the number of patients you'd need to prove that would be effective in a very young cohort of pups would be prohibitive. I think most of us agree that it's probably something that'll never really be able to be truly studied. The only way we could is eventually, you know, is with cohort studies. Eventually, you know, we'll get all these pups on these studies, and some of them will have started Hemlibra at a 1 month of age, let's say, and others maybe didn't for whatever reason. And then, even though it's not a great way to do a study, that's probably the only way we'll have to get some answers. So yeah, so that's the long answer. But in a nutshell, yeah, that's basically the situation as to how we have to have a totally different discussion now with parents. And yeah, so as a result of that, I had one family at 5 weeks of age. Based on this discussion, we started Hemlibra. And another baby who actually already had an intracranial hemorrhage right after birth, who started Hemlibra at 1 week of age. We did Factor for a week, and then we're like, well, what are we going to do? Keep this baby in the hospital till he's like 3 months old? And you know, that there's obviously issues with that. So we kind of bit the bullet and said, we'll stop the factor at 1 week, thinking, okay, we got enough factor in there to stop the bleeding, and then rely on Hemlibra at that point. So yeah, there's really different discussions to be had because of that.
And as someone who has done a lot of research into inhibitors as well, there's discussion about if you're using Hemlibra, you haven't tolerized, if there's an inhibitor, it hasn't necessarily been tolerized. Is it problematic then? If you start Hemlibra before X number of exposure days, are we then uncertain about the prevalence of an inhibitor? Could it then reap its head at an unfortunate point? You probably have about as much knowledge and perspective on this as anybody, so I would just love to hear you speak to that.
Yeah. I mean, so there's no such thing as a free lunch, right? So I discussed that in my talk. Before Hemlibra, right, the natural history of inhibitors was you'd start prophylaxis, you know, when you're a baby, I don't know, a year old, let's say, 9 months, a year, 15 months. And we know that inhibitors pretty much are going to happen in the first 50 exposure days, virtually 100%. Well, if you're on prophylaxis at twice a week or three times a week, it doesn't take a long time. I mean, within 4 months, 6 months, you hit the 50 exposure days. So before you're even 2 years old, we know you have an inhibitor or you don't. If you don't, you'll probably never get one. If you do, then we'll deal with it. The issue with starting Hemlibra before you hit 50 exposure days, certainly, I mean, most of the inhibitors come by 20 exposure days, about 95%. Certainly before 20 exposure days, is what are you going to do about the factor VIII? And so there are really a few ways to go about that that I had presented. One was you could just say, you know, the hell with it. Hemlibra works. If my son gets an inhibitor, actually one mom even said, if he gets an inhibitor, what's the difference? Just stays on Hemlibra, right? I'm like, yeah, I guess so. I never thought about if you get an inhibitor, what's the difference? You never really, because inhibitors are problematic, right? Now, I don't agree with that. I mean, there is a problem if you get an inhibitor. I don't want anybody to walk away from this discussion thinking getting an inhibitor these days is no big deal. It is still a big deal. But one option is to say, I'm not going to add any factor VIII. And then, you know, if and when an inhibitor comes, we'll deal with it. Now, the thing is, the time it would take to get to 20 exposure days based on how effective Hemlibra is. So I think Robert Sedonia, it's somebody in his team, they just did a little bit of math based, you know, they did a mathematical model based on the data. And I think they estimated that on average, it would take 13 years until you get to 20 exposure days, which means that the whole thing about getting an inhibitor, instead of knowing by the time you're two, for the most part, you're going to have to wait this thing out for 10, 12, 15 or more years. And the problem there is that the inhibitor could happen to show up at a really bad time, right? A teenager was, I don't know, playing sports. He kind of fell, hit his head, got an injury, got taken to the hospital, is going to get some factor, needs some surgery. And now the inhibitor is rearing up and you're giving factor VIII and this kid is bleeding and the surgery's not going well. I mean, that, you know, there's a potential nightmare scenario there. Now, with a hematologist, yeah, you quickly be like, oh yeah, maybe there's an inhibitor and we could adjust, but there's going to be a problem. So the other two options are, one is to go ahead and start the Hemlibra, but at some point when it's reasonable with a port or without a port to add factor VIII. And you can add factor VIII, you know, twice a week, once a week, three times a week. Dr. Sedonia is actually doing a study where they're doing it every other week. The problem with every other week is then it takes 2 years to get to 50 exposure days. So you're kind of going at it for a while. I think once a week makes sense. You probably don't need a port. Once a week, by a year, you're at 50 exposure days and you know whether you have an inhibitor or not. So that's one other path to go. And then the other path, which a patient of mine actually took after a long discussion, was basically they said, you know what, Dr., we want to know if he's going to have an inhibitor or not. So now, he happened to be 9 months old at the time. He said, let's start prophylaxis. So we went prophylaxis, no port. He happened to be on an extended half-life product twice a week. And we did it for about 5 months. He got to like 45, 46 exposure days, and then his veins were completely shot. We couldn't even get another dose in. But, you know, he got to 45. So the chances of getting an inhibitor now is pretty close to zero. And they said, okay, now we know he didn't get an inhibitor. Now we know he doesn't have an inhibitor. Now we're going to go to emicizumab. So that family, at least they know, they don't have to worry about an inhibitor in their child. And now they can just go with emicizumab without that concern if you don't do it. So, you know, all of these things are real life scenarios for which we don't have data, for which we don't really have experience even. And we're kind of figuring out as we go. There are some studies that are going to try to deal with some of that, but not everything is going to be able to be answered with a study.
That was an important conversation with Dr. Young, and such a specific conversation with such an expert in infancy and managing and treating hemophilia for infants. And so I know those decisions for families are very difficult, and I appreciated Dr. Young really going into the very specific and personalized yes. avenues of treatments that we have now, in particular with infants, first exposures, how many exposures to clotting factor, and of course the, you know, the new and very, you know, changing innovative, you know, stuff that we have with emicizumab. So I loved that that piece with Dr. Young.
Likewise, yeah, and a good reminder too for anyone who did attend the BDC, who is a registered member of the Bleeding Disorders Conference. Dr. Young was involved in numerous sessions on novel therapies, on gene therapy, speaking about emicizumab. So if you do want to hear more from him and you registered for the conference, those sessions will be available until the end of the month. So you can check those out via hemophilia.org. So following emicizumab, we are in this state now of anticipating gene therapy, as we've talked about plenty. And Dr. Kwan spoke with us about gene therapy, not so much the anticipation of it as what exactly is it that we're talking about when we say gene therapy? And here's Dr. Kwan to answer that.
Currently, gene therapy in hemophilia is looking at a transfer. So you're trying to get the a correct working, I shouldn't say correct, but a working factor 8 or factor 9 gene back into the body and get it to make the protein that is missing or dysfunctional. So whatever gene that you pick, and lots of thought has gone into the correct gene to use for factor 8 and factor 9, you try to get that into the body. And currently, we're using vectors, and we call those viral vectors. So a virus that has been modified, and I know everybody's scared right now because the coronavirus can cause all kinds of disease, right?
Yeah.
So they've done a lot of investigation, and they've identified viruses that do not cause significant disease in humans. And they have taken those, and literally, like, we know all of the sequence, like we can sequence DNA, right? We took those sequences and took out all the ones that could cause any problems and just made a shell of that virus. And so we now have this viral particle that's just a shell. And then you put in the gene of interest that you're trying to correct or fix, and then put that into the body.
Interesting.
And so you hope that that will go to, and you can target it. And in this case, we're targeting the liver because clotting factors are made in the liver. So that was the short version of a gene therapy.
And
that's how they're doing it. So in different disease states, they may be doing it differently. So sickle cell may be doing a different type of gene therapy, and it's also a genetic disorder. Mm-hmm. So it might be doing a different type of gene therapy than hemophilia, than that muscular dystrophy, like Duchenne's muscular dystrophy may be doing it slightly differently.
Right.
I'm not an expert in that area, so I can never address Duchenne's muscular dystrophy, which is very common, or not common, but a genetic disorder that can affect people.
And Dr. Kwan, as you were saying, the viral vector goes to the liver because that's where the proteins will be produced from.
Mm-hmm.
But what then happens once the viral vector reaches the liver? Does the whole thing stay there? Does that viral shell stay in the liver? What actually happens
Good
to the
question.
Whole package?
Yeah. So your package gets delivered, and like when you... I like that Dr. Pipe's sort of delivery system where it's an Amazon box, right? So the viral shell is akin to the box. And once you get your package, you open it. And so that DNA then the virus gets into the shell with the package, the gene inside gets into the cell, and then it has to get into the nucleus, which is sort of where all your DNA is. And then it delivers that our DNA of interest into the nucleus. But you have all of your DNA, which is in chromosomes. And then you have this little extra piece of DNA that has your gene of interest, and in our case, either factor 8 or factor 9, and it just sits outside of your own DNA. So the package gets delivered into the nucleus, so it gets targeted to the nucleus, and then it goes into the nucleus and sits there. So your DNA isn't affected, and the outside DNA that you added just sits there and gets made. That's what we're hoping, to take advantage of the machinery that's already inside the nucleus to get that protein made.
And you were talking before about gene editing, and which is in preclinical trials. And I'm guessing that at that point in the process, there's a big difference between sitting outside and with gene editing actually going in and changing structurally the DNA.
So it'd have to go. So it would have to do all of those steps that we talked about, get through your body. So it's given to you IV, right? That single infusion is what they talk about for gene therapy for these kind of methods. So you get inside your body, finally go to your target, get inside the cell, and then go into the nucleus. So gene editing would have to do the same thing, but the mechanism would be different. Instead of having the gene factor 8 or factor 9 sit outside your DNA, the things that it would start editing your own DNA. So it would somehow find your factor 8 or factor 9 gene, and sort of it, and I've heard this cut and paste kind of a mechanism, right? Where you would find your factor 8 or factor 9 gene, sort of cut out what's missing and replace with what's functional.
And that's super interesting. I feel like we could spend a lot of time talking about that. But given that it sounds like we're still a ways away from that being something that, unless someone's involved in a clinical trial, will really be widely available. Is that accurate?
Yes. And I believe they've done it in animals, and they can, but it's different in animals, right? You can control the environment and everything, whereas here it's a little harder to control everything that's going on.
What is it that you are and will be looking for in the very near future when gene therapy is made available, whenever that may be? What is it that you will be looking for, curious about, keeping an eye on as patients make the choice to use it and are reporting experiences, kind of that follow-on data? What will you be looking for?
So if you, first of all, the big goal, of course, is to make factor 8, right? Or factor 9. And the patients are followed for so many things, you know. So let's say you join Patrick or your brother or whoever joins a trial, right? So at the beginning of a trial, especially in these gene therapies, you're there almost every week for labs. You've literally a pincushion, I call it, because you're constantly getting labs. So sure. If you have an aversion to having labs drawn, this is not something that you want to do.
Which is not an insignificant point.
No. Come on, you're doing it every week some studies, it's only 12 weeks, and then it moves to every month for another, full year. So even then, it's still a lot of blood draws. For some studies, it's much longer, 40 plus weeks, right? So you get labs drawn every week, and we follow so many different things. You follow the factor levels, of course. We are very interested. Remember I said it was targeting the liver? Well,
yes.
The liver can tell you if it's inflamed or angry, so to speak. And it'll leak out these enzymes. And we check for those enzymes every week. And sometimes even more if we find that they're starting to be, so we get your baseline, we know what your baseline should be. And if it starts to go up, even if it's in the normal limits, because the normal can go from, for example, 15 to 40, right? That's a big range.
Big range, yeah.
Right, and if you're starting out at 22 and it goes up to 40, it's still within the normal range, that 40, but it's higher than your baseline of 22. So is something going on? And so we're monitoring it, not just flagging an abnormal lab, but actually have to look at every lab and say, it's different from your baseline. And so we'll have to look at it much more closely and decide whether or not your liver is inflamed and start medication for that.
Dr. Cohen, we have a question from one of our attendees. What percentage of the community do you think will latch on to the gene therapy treatment as a treatment option when it comes out?
That's a good question. I don't know if I can answer that because you have to be eligible or qualify. And one of those qualifications is you have to get tested to see if you've had immunity to that particular virus. So have you been exposed to that virus? If you have been exposed and you will have immunity, and people might understand this in light of coronavirus right now, right? That they say, we talk about antibodies and how you measure it and things like that. So we can measure your antibodies and see if you've been exposed to it. If you've been exposed to it, then you may have immunity, meaning that if we give you that viral shell containing the gene, it'll sense it as, oh my God, this is a virus and I'm gonna get rid of you. And so the antibodies will come and attack that virus and it won't be as effective.
Is it invasive to find that out? Is it
no, something it's that, just a blood draw. It's just a blood draw. Mm-hmm.
And is there anything that we know about the prevalence of that immunity amongst our community or what leads to it?
Yeah, so there have been studies done and the different viruses. So mostly we have been using for hemophilia studies, adeno-associated virus. There are different types of viruses. So adeno-associated virus or AAV. So you might hear everybody saying AAV vector. So it stands for adeno-associated virus. And that one prevalence depending on where you are, like geographically, but a number might be around 25%.
Wow, okay. So it's a significant number.
Yes. And so not everybody will be quote, eligible for that. So we have to check.
Is it worth, and I guess there's insurance questions in this too, but it feels to me like, it feels to me like it would be worth screening for that, like sooner than not, whether or not you're thinking about gene therapy in 6 months or 6 years, just the psychological knowledge that it's an option for me or not feels kind of important.
Well, the problem is that if I test today, right, I'm negative, but if I test a year from now, will I have been exposed to it?
Sure.
And then will I be positive? So it might give you an idea now to do it, but then we still have to retest. And so patients that I actually enrolled into a beginning part of that trial were eligible, but disappointment because 6 months later when we retested them, they became positive. So they may have had, like I said, it doesn't cause a huge disease. Maybe you had a runny nose for one day and thought, oh, it's allergies, and let it go. And it could have been that virus that caused you to have such a minor thing that you just didn't think anything about it. So I have had somebody negative and then turn positive. I've actually had two different patients in two different trials have that happen.
They were negative and they turned positive.
Yeah, because they got exposed.
Yeah.
Again, it's just so, again, you have to choose something that's not going to cause any major issue in your body, in humans. And so they must have gotten it in passing somehow. And I know neither of them claimed, well, one of them, this was early on, one of them said that their father was sick, but they weren't sick. So maybe he did get exposed to it.
Yeah.
He was asymptomatic.
Were they were they pretty bummed when
yes.
they found out?
Yeah.
To put it mildly. Yeah. Well, how do you navigate that part?
That's a lot. I mean, just like any other bad news, you have to talk them through it. And alternatives, you know, you continue your normal treatment until something else comes around. And as I said, the technology is always advancing and people are working on gene therapies that are non-viral based, like mm-hmm. other ways to get them into your body that is not based on a virus vector. There are other things that are going on that you can get it in. Some other type of nanoparticles or things like that. I'm not really familiar with it, but there are other people working. Mm-hmm. Apparently, right now, I guess that type of technology is in its infancy and for disease, genetic disorders kind of thing.
Dr. Kwan is excellent, and I'm happy to say my hematologist, because I very much enjoy listening to her speak about that which she is expert in. In fact, I did it yesterday at my annual clinic visit. But one thing that I think comes through in what she was talking about there, especially at the end, was expectations related to the gene therapy, gene transfer process. Expectations such as, not everyone with hemophilia is going to be, hemophilia A is going to qualify for this. You may have immunity to the virus being used as the vector to bring the gene into your body. And you might test that you are, that you're good to go. You have no immunity to that. Sign up for the trial, go through the process. You show up for day one. And I'm sorry, you have since been exposed to that virus. You have developed antibodies. You are no longer qualified. And that will happen. That will happen to certain people in this process at some point. And it's very important that we're prepared for what adopting this new treatment class will look like as a community and for us as individuals, what all the potential outcomes for us could be. It's very important that we appreciate those details so that we don't set ourselves up for massive disappointment, frustration. That's a whole catastrophic, what do they call it? I'm doing a gesture that only Amy can see. What is this gesture, Amy?
Like a spiral?
Circling the drain, spiral, downward spiral. That's yeah, what right, I'm looking there for. There you go, there you go. Spinning my finger around like, oh, it's a basketball. Is this how you do it? Maybe this is how you do it. But anyway, Dr. Kwan, thank you as always. And thank you for being an excellent hematologist for me.
And actually, what a shift that treatment for hemophilia is not going to be black and white anymore.
Yeah.
And the emotional, and just like you said, the emotional expectations, because that's the reality. There's going to be so much disappointment and anger, and it's just not the reality. So mm-hmm. becoming comfortable within the uncomfortable is going to be a very tricky emotional place, but
it's why we need community. It's why we got to keep
yes.
supporting each other, showing up to events, staying engaged, sharing experiences, because things are going to get more complex, not less complex. We may be getting healthier and having better quality of lives as a community as we progress here, but not for a lack of complexity. So right. we got to stay connected. We got to stay informed. Amy, why don't you tee us up for this last segment, since you and Dr. Mike have a lovely history.
Oh my gosh, Dr. Mike. So our next physician is Dr. Michael Wong. He is the clinical director at the University of Colorado, HTC. He is my mentor. And just as a personal note, it was my favorite part of the conference to have Patrick get to like have a conversation with Dr. Mike. I have had countless.
I felt so bad. I felt I was monopolizing that. Terribly.
Oh my gosh. It like made my day. I have had countless, you know, Dr. Mike used to like, we would go out to lunch and just talk about things. And he is so aware of this human emotional expectation. He has a humanistic side
yes.
to him as
yes,
well
really
as
does.
A clinical scientific side to him. He is a diamond in the rough and he explains things so well. And he sees things from a business point of view in terms of reimbursement and just the overall systemic issues of healthcare that have really inspired me in my path. So it was a joy, and I'm so looking forward to you all getting to hear Dr. Mike a little bit. We kind of chose this clip. He really goes into the outlook of all these new novel therapies, and at the end he kind of speaks to his experience of what he's witnessed from some of his patients on gene therapy clinical trials. It was very special. So we're excited for you guys to hear more from Dr. Mike.
Is there anything in the other in the non-factor investigational category that kind of gets overshadowed? And there's also factor that's being investigated too that gets overshadowed by the gene therapy. Is there anything from those buckets that are of particular interest to you?
Safety. I mean, I think the concizumab and the fituzuran trials are going to allow us to understand coagulation very deeply, right?
So why is that?
Because there's a huge amount of concern that you cannot rebalance the coagulation system by it's like you can't make two wrongs into a right.
Okay.
And so that you were probably exposing the patient to some tremendous risk. David Lillycraft spoke about this a couple of years ago. He put up this great slide about the evolution of the coagulation system. And coagulation proteins haven't changed in millions of years. And he's like, you know, there probably is a reason why our coagulation system, as imperfect as it is the way it is, and it's been this way for a long, long, long time.
That's interesting.
Any perturbation in it causes a problem. And so that's the counter argument for all the rebalancing therapies. I think the Unicure factor VIII gene therapy thing is fascinating, right? They're going to make an emicizumab-like molecule, right? I believe that's what they're proposing to basically, instead of making sub-Q emicizumab, you're going to just make it yourself. That's fascinating, but you know, I don't know. I mean,
are there any concerns in the way that there's still concerns about non-tolerized inhibitors if you're treating with Hemlibra or emicizumab, but you still have the underlying inhibitor that could complicate matters and treating bleeds? Does that concern exist with a concizumab as well?
So yeah.
It doesn't solve for that piece of it. It's just a greater expression in a way of the molecule's abilities.
Right, you're right. So, you know, the data point that makes everybody really nervous about the rebalancing therapies, and it could be false, is that the one thing that we follow in patients who have blood clots is a molecule called a D-dimer. And when it's elevated, we know that the person's coagulation system has been turned on, that a clot has been made, and when the clot's broken down, when it's enzymatically clipped into pieces, one of those pieces is called the D-dimer, and it's stoichiometrically related to the amount of clot burden or the amount of clot that's there. And so when you have an elevated D-dimer, we know two things had to have happened. One is that your coagulation system is turned on and that you've made a clot. Because you cannot make a dimer without actually making a clot first. And so concizumab and fituzuran patients have high dimers. And so they're not bleeding, they're not having overt thrombosis, but they're running around with the fragments of a broken down clot. And so that's scary to people.
And we don't quite know why.
Or where, or how much, yeah. Like where is that being generated? Is that all at your endothelial surface and it's just a slow turnover of whatever is dysregulated at where that molecule is? Are you making little clots and then breaking them down? I don't know.
Is there any reason to think that that's or could be connected to any of the thrombotic adverse events that have occurred?
Mm-hmm. Everyone thinks so. Like if you look at the dose of factor VIII or factor IX that you get if you're on fituzuran, it's tiny. Right, I think your correction for factor VIII is 30% for a major bleed, or less than that. Maybe it's 10 units per kilo if you have a major bleed and you're on fituzuran. So that's going to be the big trick for people at HTCs if people go onto that drug, for instance. And we don't know what the equivalent is for concizumab. Is that when a person calls you and says I'm bleeding, they may not have bled in a few years. And so they're probably calling you because they want to know, just, you know, I don't quite remember what you told me 2 years ago about this, but I know there's something different. Well, if the dude on the other side of the phone doesn't know what's different, they're going to tell them to take a normal dose.
Right.
And so you have to ensure on the front end, right, that the patient at home has no other dose but the small dose. But let's say they forget their dose, they go to an ER. I mean, all those stupid things are gonna hop out. I mean, the education around treating bleeding is going to be giant for all of these products. And this protein C inhibitor that's being worked on at Penn, same thing. You know, we're not certain how unbraked your coagulation system is because you're inhibiting it so much that if you goose it just a little bit, you know, how much do you have to step on the gas? It's really tricky to know. I mean, you learn that in patisiran because a person got a clot, but they also knew this because, you know, they could spike it in vitro. So I think that probably going forward, there's going to be a lot more modeling, let's say, of coagulation, and there's going to be better guesses as to safe dosing, initial dosing. But I think that's going to be, you know, a big difference. And of course, that just drops factor consumption, if you're thinking economically, right down.
Right.
I mean, if everyone gets on emicizumab, fituzuran, I mean, you could say that every factor 8 and factor 9 patient in the United States doesn't need to be infusing factors prophylaxis.
Only if they were all on one of those.
Right. And we know how much people infuse on emicizumab, frighteningly little. And so the whole factor market, which supports the world, right? The U.S. factor pricing market supports world pricing.
Hmm.
Will collapse.
I guess in kind of summarizing what we've been talking about, what will you be looking for, you know, most, or what are the top 2-3 things you're going to be looking for, assuming that there's an approval in 18 days and we're going to face these things in reality? What are you going to be keeping an eye on and talking to colleagues about?
I think one is patient selection, and then HTC readiness probably are the two things. I think, like, as a region, we have to decide who we're going to recommend gene therapy to initially, and where we think it should be done, and kind of the minimum requirements. You know, payers have floated the idea that they want to certify either centers or physicians or teams to be able to take care of these patients because they feel like it's their investment. It's not only the investment of the patient's life, of course it is, but they want to kind of double down on that. You know, they're not gonna believe that, you know, your ethical obligation to the care of the patient is enough. They want to certify that you know what you're doing, that you know, have at least been educated or experienced or whatever, something that reassures them that when their patient gets that, that they're in good hands. And I do have a sense that might come down, that there's going to be a certification process.
That would make sense. That makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Well, thank you for this time. This has been a lot to think about. Frankly, cause for concern, but that's okay. Sometimes there's cause for concern, and just got to keep paying attention as things shift and change. And
yeah,
man, individualized medicine feels like it. But the more and more that we, I guess, learn about the science, and the more that treatments teach us about the human response to various manipulations, right, it really does make the case for the need for individualized medicine. The whole financial business component is something else, but
right.
Wow, what a time to be alive.
No, it's great.
With hemophilia.
No, it is. No, I think that the choices are tremendous, right? And
yes.
And I think that many of them will have led and will lead patients to healthier and better lives regardless. I mean, you know, a consequence for a number of our patients on gene therapy is that they're healthier.
Right.
I mean, they are just healthier. They don't drink, they exercise, you know, they talk, they talk to themselves or their spouses more. They see themselves as better fathers. One guy's like, I'm a better dad. He said, I'm just a better person. I am fundamentally a better person.
Wow.
I'm a person that I wouldn't have thought that I couldn't have predicted this as an outcome of this. Right.
Wow.
Right. It's like a person who stops doing cocaine. Right. Right. You're not a bad person underneath all of that. Right.
Right.
But they don't know it. They don't see it. They don't allow other people to experience them in that way. And then when it hits them, like, oh, this is the potential, right? Now I can have a purpose and I can execute that purpose.
Yes.
It's pretty powerful.
Dr. Mike, what do you attribute that to? I mean, obviously they have to stop drinking during the trial and those types of things, but the weight of thinking about infusions or the chronic pain issues, does that play into it? What plays into that mental health shift?
Yeah, you know, I don't know. You know, Glenn talks about this a lot after his liver transplant. I think one big part is that for the first time, many people, I mean, Mark Skinner always talks about this idea that hemophilia patients are preconditioned to what they can and cannot do by the time they're an adult. Mm. They have a very fixed mindset about what they're capable and incapable of doing. And both of those things actually limit them because they don't execute what they're fully capable of doing, and they might be overestimating what they're incapable of doing. Mm-hmm. And I think what happens is that over time, people, one, they get over this relief, they lose fear, right? Like Glenn always told me, he couldn't believe for 3, 4, 5, 6 months that he wouldn't bleed in the morning, that he wouldn't wake up and not have a bleed. He said he just didn't believe it. He'd wake up every morning and think, is today the day that I'm going to wake up with a knee bleed? And it just never happened. But he said it took him months to actually believe that was real. And he said once he believed that was real, he didn't have the fear of that anymore. And then once he didn't have that, he wasn't carrying around that. He said he started to broaden what he felt his life could be. And so maybe there are lots of little pieces in there, Amy.
Well, thanks again for the time, Dr. Mike.
Thank you, Dr. Mike. Thank you, Dr. Kwan, Dr. Young, Dr. Valentino. And thank you to Spark for making the science fair possible. The science fair this year, of course, like everything, a fully virtual experience, meant that we adapted it in our platform that we're very proud of to an online experience. So if you go to thesciencefair.org, you can take yourself through, well, Dr. Morales will guide you through the science fair, my favorite animated physician. No offense to other animated physicians who may be listening. So thesciencefair.org, and a big shout out to Spark for making that possible. And just before we go, another podcast that people might be interested in if you have stuck around to listen to the end of today's episode is something that Amy has been working on. You've heard us talk about it before, but I think given today's news, Amy, it's maybe more relevant now than it has been thus far.
Absolutely. It's In the Genes, a gene therapy podcast. Episode 3 is out this week. It's all about clinical trials. And we have a research nurse working in a gene therapy center at Boston Children's taking us through what the clinical trial process is like. And it's just really good stuff. Again, expectation management. When we're going through this, I mean, it is a massive, you know, undertaking. And for those of us kind of thinking about if we want to do this in the future, it might not be a clinical trial process, but the actual product is going to be a lot. It's not going to be one and done. There's going to be a lot of data collection. And so just to have that in mind of what that's going to be. So check it out. It's great. And she's
really
wonderful.
Is.
Yes. Colleen Dansereau from Boston Children's is our guest. And as I say in the beginning, everything should be explained by a nurse, like not just clinical things, like everything should be explained by a nurse. So it's a great episode. I highly recommend.
So maybe what we really needed is for Clarissa to become a nurse. No.
OMG.
Was that just... Should I have left that one on the cutting room floor before I even opened my mouth?
100%. If people have stuck around this long, I hope that they like...
You should appreciate a good Clarissa Explains It All reference. And if you don't, I don't need you listening anymore.
It's okay.
No.
That might have aged us, but it's cool. It's cool. I feel fine. I feel fine.
Look, the silver streaking through my hair has started that process years ago. So Clarissa Explains It All ain't got nothing on the age of this fella. But with that, we have certainly used up our time and energy. So we will say farewell for now. Check out It's in the Genes. As Amy said at the top of the show, if you do want to share with us your thoughts, your feelings, your expectations, your hopes, dreams, fears as it relates to gene therapy, or really anything to do with being a member of the bleeding disorders community, reach out to Amy Board, reach out to Patrick James Lynch, reach out to mailbag at bloodstreammedia.com. You can find Bloodstream Media on Instagram, on Facebook, on Twitter. You can find Amy Board or Patrick James Lynch on any one of those places as well. If you're not a subscriber to Bloodstream, oh, come on, you're still here. You may as well be a subscriber. You like the Clarissa jokes, you stuck around, be a subscriber. And share the show with others. Tell others that's the best way that Bloodstream and what we provide here can reach other members of our community. We'll be back next week with our next episode. And until then, my name is Patrick James Lynch.
Take care, everybody. My name's Amy Board.
Take self-care of yourself, indeed. Bye, everybody.
Bye.